I'm Dr. Emily Silverman, and welcome to Talking Dementia with Remo Health. Join us as we explore the latest advances, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we sit down with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Jason Karlowish. Jason is a physician and professor at the University of Pennsylvania who specializes in dementia care, ethics, and aging. As co-director of the Penn Memory Center and leader of several national Alzheimer's initiatives, he combines clinical care with research on cognitive impairment, informed consent, and patient autonomy. His work, including the book, The Problem of Alzheimer's, highlights the ethical and social challenges of dementia while advocating for compassionate, community-centered care. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks, Emily. It's great to be here.
So, Jason, I know your book came out several years ago and a lot has changed since then, but I would like to start with the book because it is such a wonderful encapsulation of where we were with Alzheimer's at the time that it was written. So tell us about your decision to write that book. I know that initially you had set out to write a memoir, but then the book changed into this sweeping account of Alzheimer's as a cultural and political crisis. So tell us about writing the book and how things have evolved since the book came out.
When I wrote the book, it became clear to me as I was doing the research to put it together, kind of putting the ideas finally to ABC, that my story was part of a very larger story that is still unfolding and really very exciting ways, namely how a disease that was not even thought of as a disease, namely Alzheimer's and other causes of dementia, became a disease and then became all of a sudden a crisis. And I decided that's the story to tell. And why did that happen? And you can pinpoint very specific events over the course of the 20th century that explain that. I zeroed in on America because there's some very contextual specific issues about what happened in America, but it's kind of the similar in other countries. And so what I came up with was a story that sort of blended my story with bigger stories, the stories that begin in Germany in the early 20th century when Alois Alzheimer's got to work and then had his work shut down, and picks it up again in the late 20th century when Alzheimer's is rediscovered the way Alzheimer's conceived it. So that's what motivated the book. When the book ended, the Alzheimer's field was in a difficult place. The book ended with, actually, the paperback has an afterword about the FDA's mistaken approval of aducanumab using the accelerated approval mechanism. And I wrote about that. And the very conclusion of that afterword was that really the problem of Alzheimer's, the problem is us humans trying to figure out how to deal with the disease of autonomy and struggling with exercising our autonomy and trying to come together a sort of one nation, one people to solve this problem. And the aducanumab decision, I think, revealed that problem, that human problem, very plainly. Now, since then, though, things have changed, and I think we should probably talk about that.
Well, before we talk about what's changed, maybe you can lay out for the listeners, you know, these are people, families, patients who are living with dementia, many of them likely with Alzheimer's dementia in particular, about that epilogue or that chapter after the book that came out later about the FDA and the approval of that medication. And maybe you can just summarize that for us.
You know, Biogen, a very excellent pharmaceutical company that's made a lot of advances in the neuroscience space in particular, had for a number of years been working on a drug called aducanumab, which is a drug that targets one of the pathologies that leads to dementia caused by Alzheimer's, namely amyloid protein. And they'd had a series of studies that were very promising that certainly showed some of the key things you need to say that a drug might be working. But things kind of got a little messy in their pivotal study to show that the drug was safe and effective for the treatment of people with mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia caused by Alzheimer's disease. The result was a study and a data set that was really kind of flawed. Unfortunately, FDA ran that data set in conjunction with the company. And the net bottom line outcome was they granted the drug what was called accelerated approval, which was an FDA regulatory mechanism that allows a drug to be approved on the basis only of not showing that it actually benefits patients, but it changes a marker of the disease, with the promise that the company would subsequently do studies to prove that the drug actually was safe and effective. It was really a failure of regulatory science. It was not about the drug or Biogen. They did what they wanted to do, but it's about the FDA not having, I think, the regulatory scientific smarts and muscle to say, we're just, this is not the drug to approve with accelerated approval. And I think it was a good example of, you know, the political challenges, the human factors that have for decades, with this disease in particular, for a variety of reasons, made it a very difficult disease for us to tackle, made it a crisis, and have made it a difficult disease to tackle. So that's the aducanumab story. That drug, as a sort of coda, is off the market. Biogen ultimately was unable to really get it into practice, and finally, about a year ago, withdrew it from the market. So it's not available to offer prescription. Since then, though, things have changed.
You said sometimes the approval in this particular drug's case, the approval process is flawed. What do you think is driving that? Because I'm sure a lot of families are wondering, is it it's desperation? Or some people might wonder if it's money, if it's pharma, or you think it's a little bit of both? Or what do you think?
FDA was caught up in what's known as regulatory capture. I think they began to create a relationship with Biogen, and the congressional investigations have supported this, a relationship with Biogen that was becoming overly blended. And I think they were losing sight of their very important at a distance relationship they need to have. That, together with the desire kind of to have a win, like we're going to finally have a treatment for Alzheimer's. Mind you, this is a disease that has thwarted successful treatments for decades, meaning studies just keep on coming up negative. You know, I think advocacy groups really were able to play the emotional story of desperation and hope, which I think are a start. We have to have emotions to act as humans, but, you know, hope is not a plan. It is not a strategy. And I think if you are proving on the basis of hope and desperation, you sort of open up no longer practicing regulatory science. You open yourself up to, I don't know what else. It's something different. And that's what happened. And, you know, since then, many people at the FDA predates the current administration left. And I do think it was kind of a wake-up call that they were getting a little too frisky with the accelerated approval mechanism.
I want to talk about what has happened since then, but before we do, let's just go through some of the basics here, because a lot of the listeners may not be familiar with you and your work and how you think and talk about Alzheimer's disease. So let's start with something you said earlier, which is that you've described Alzheimer's as a disease of autonomy. How does that framing change the way that we think about and talk about and care for people living with Alzheimer's disease?
Years ago, I sort of was sitting there jotting in my notebook, and that idea suddenly hit me. A couple of weeks later, I had dinner with Brian James, a brilliant epidemiologist at Rush University, and I shared the idea with him, and he goes, yeah, you're right, that's what it is. And to say that Alzheimer's is a disease of autonomy is to kind of get the heart of the problem, which is the reason why cognitive losses, losses in perception, changes in perceptual abilities, changes in emotional processing, the reason why we call that a disease is because it takes away our ability to be you, to be Emily, to be Jason. And ultimately, really, it's a disease of the mind. I like framing it as a disease of autonomy, though, although I also frame it as a disease of the mind, because that gets to the human, political, social, ethical aspect of why we call it a disease. Because for a number of years, centuries, we normalize these disabilities in older adults. In other words, there have always been people with dementia in the arc of history. They've been described. You know, Ralph Waldo Emerson apparently had, you know, clearly had Alzheimer's. I mean, so there's nothing, it's not like this is a 20th century phenomenon because of something in the water, if you will. But for centuries, we just set it aside and said, well, that's just aging. And I don't think it was just the science at work. I think one of the reasons why Alois Alzheimer's discoveries in the early 1900s, which were essentially saying this is a disease, never took off, was because we didn't have a robust understanding that all humans should be treated as autonomous individuals entitled to self-determine their lives. Mind you, in 1900, when Alois Alzheimer's, the German neuropathologist who first described this disease, did his work, if you were of a certain genders in certain cultures, you were not allowed to vote, you were not allowed to hold property. If you were of certain races or ethnicities in certain locations, you could be bought and sold. Or at least that had been a legacy up until fairly recently. And we could just kind of run the list of all of the ways of being you that were thwarted by, we hadn't yet fully realized the ethical autonomy is essential to what it means to be a human. And I think that was really key to take what was called senility, which everyone knew was horrible, and say, this is bad. We need to do something about it. And the way we're going to do it is, well, does medicine offer an answer? Yes, we see amyloid plaques in the brain. And oh, well, then maybe it's a disease. Yes, that's not there usually. Okay, then great, let's go after it. And that's the story in the late 20th century, when all of a sudden this hidden plain sight problem was reframed as something that we need to do something about. It's not normal as an older adult to become densely forgetful, disorganized, anxious, etc. This needs to be figured out. It needs to be diagnosed. It needs to be treated, and ideally, it needs to be cured.
You wrote in your book that one of the ways that you start visits with a new patient is by asking, "What is a typical day like?" So, tell us about that question. It's such a simple question, but it's so revealing. And I was just wondering if you could tell us about that and why you start there.
Yeah, well, not to play to a fellow writer, but it's a way to really kind of use the power of narrative in medicine, which is ultimately medicine is a history of present illness. And illness, as opposed to disease, is your story. In other words, every person, they all say every case is different. Well, what I think they're getting at is the illness experience is so different. Anyway, the question, what's a typical day, allows me rich, robust data with respect to where's this, I'm going to talk like a doctor, or, where's this brain living? What's it doing? Or not doing, as it were. And it does it in a very non-threatening way, I think, meaning it just opens up you to hear the story of how someone lives their life. I think it's also quite revealing when I ask it of a family member, how much do they know? I mean, how much are they aware of this person's daily life versus, well, you know, I actually don't know. I only see her once a month. And, you know, it's usually at our uncle's house. And then I know, well, you know, that we have some problems here. Namely, no one can really help me get history outside of the patient, which I'm not discounting. And also, if I do make a diagnosis of a disease like Alzheimer's or Lewy body disease or TDP-43, you know, this person might be in some real trouble with respect to getting the kind of supports they need to live well. So it's a very useful question diagnostically, therapeutically, and to build a relationship that by the time you see me is probably going to happen.
How do you think about those singular narratives compared with the blunt tools that we have, you know, for example, the quizzes and the games and the neuropsych testing and sort of those functional tests that are meant to be more objective? Obviously, each has their role, but how do you think of them differently and how do you use them?
But it's an assembly. I like that word, assembly. You know, you take things and you put them together into something bigger and more coherent. So you need the narrative for diagnostic purposes, for staging purposes, for care purposes. You need those other tests, though, to kind of firm up the facts and get a sense of, ultimately, do all the facts line up to tell a story that fits with the typical story of one of the diseases that causes dementia. In many cases, it does. Not that infrequently, though, it doesn't totally line up. And that's where things become sort of challenging diagnoses. I think we can overly fetishize our cognitive testing. We can overly fetishize the history. I think all that data needs to be put together to come up with a compendious assembly of what is going on with this person right now and in the beginning. New patient visit, of course, or at the start of a new patient relationship, it's what's the diagnosis? Diagnosis, diagnosis, diagnosis. And I've had a lot of transformative thoughts about that in the last couple of years.
When somebody breaks their leg or has a spinal cord injury or something like that, they may need a wheelchair to get around temporarily or permanently. And in your book, you talk about how with these diseases of autonomy, Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia, the caregiver serves as the sort of wheelchair of the mind. They are the, I guess, apparatus or device that helps the person navigate the world. So tell us more about caregiving and how you think about caregiving and how, you know, if they're so important to the well-being of the person, just like a wheelchair, how do we think about supporting caregivers as well?
It's funny, in a lot of my writing and thinking, I spend a lot of time ultimately saying back in different words something that's been there all along, but it's just a reframing. And at least personally, I often find the reframing to be sort of transformative in my thinking about the thing. In this case, the thing, if you will, is a caregiver. A quirky term, to be sure, very modern term. There weren't caregivers before about 1980 in America. There were caregivers, we just didn't call them that. They were just a good wife or daughter doing the work of a good wife or daughter, typically. Anyway, I digress. If you think about, you're right, if you break a leg, you know, you've got a host of devices, literally mechanical things that will help you move around and so on. I mean, physical disability. My favorite is eyeglasses and contact lenses. I'm aware of contacts, and, you know, without them, I'm kind of blind. I mean, I've got really bad myopia, but with them, you know, doing pretty well. So, you know, my contacts allow me to go from being disabled to being abled. And I think it's the same thing with a caregiver. I think a caregiver, if they do their work well, and it is demanding, difficult work, is an human, another human that helps another human suddenly become closer to functional again, closer to having their disabilities addressed. And I think that framing really captures that caregiving isn't just an underpaid maid or butler crossed with a nurse and a nurse's aide. It's a very unique, distinct job, frankly. And I call it a job, although many caregivers sort of recoil at that, because it is work. And actually, I think in some cases should be done by someone who's paid as opposed to someone who's there because of familial connections, but really doesn't want to do it, can't do it, isn't very good at it, or whatever the reasons. I mean, now we're getting into sort of like, you know, what is this job, et cetera, and what should it be paid, and what's the training for it? But that's how I think of it. I've lately been pushing the idea of caregiving into what I call mind support, because I'm very enamored sounds like an aesthetic issue. I'm very, I think, convinced that we need to think of dementia as a disorder of the mind, and that our mind is best understood as what I think is the theory of the extended mind, namely that the mind emerges from an interaction of the brain, the body, and the environment. It's not just in the brain. It isn't, period, full stop. That we only have a mind because the mind is in a body, and that body and that brain are in an environment. And so with someone with dementia caused by, say, Lewy body disease, profound changes in brain lead to profound distortions of how they perceive the environment. And that's where a human has to step in and help them recalibrate and restore, if you will, their mind. And that starts with the foundation, because our mind is an extended mind. So it all the more amplifies how, you know, caregiving, I like to call it actually, is mind support. I like to think of it sort of like life support, and it's mind support. That's what a caregiver does. That's also what our smartphone does, I think, as well.
Sometimes it gives us so much mind support that we actually lose skills. I lost my sense of direction because I rely on my GPS.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's a host of devices out there that are, I think, brilliant examples of the extended mind in action. And never mind the, quote, smart devices, even though a smartphone I don't think is smart. They're getting there, but they're not that there. But I think, you know, a notepad is something we use as an extension of our mental processes. You know, the only reason why we're able to do math problems is because we, you know, are able to take a pad and paper and sort of write it out. So that's the extended mind at work. Our humans are very, very interesting creatures. There's a couple other creatures that clearly have extended mind. I think many do. But we really take our brain really colonizes the world, and the world colonizes it.
You said that mind support, usually it's a human helping a human. And that human could be familial, you know, a wife, a daughter, usually, or it could be a paid help. What about technology? You know, they talk a lot about these dystopian worlds where we have robot caregivers and AI mind support. We talked a little bit about this a few years ago, but I'm curious just to ask you about it again, since it's been a few years.
Yeah, it's only gotten more important, because I think the spectacular advances that occurred with, you know, LLMs and the related technology that we put into the bundle of AI are really showing the power of silicon to take care of humans. And I say silicon because in the end, these are, you know, silicon-based devices, right? All these devices ultimately rely on computers, and computers sort of, I don't know, somehow they use silicon. Anyway, you know, Silicon Valley, hello. And I think it's only becoming more and more possible that you can have a neurodegenerative disease that's symptomatic, meaning it's causing you to feel it, and we're seeing changes, and devices step in and take care of things that otherwise we needed humans to do. The possibilities are really spectacular. I recently interviewed a tech entrepreneur for an essay I'm working on, and he described how he probably kept his mother in her apartment 3 more years because of all the devices he hooked up that allowed her to continue to live in her apartment. And frankly, also diminished the amount of time he was spending, and he was quite busy getting his career going and raising 2 kids and, you know, and his wife, being able to do that work at the same time. Having said that, And I think all this is great. I'm not criticizing these devices, you know, some sort of, you know, back to the life as a Shaker or, you know, Amish, you know, where we question whether light bulbs are appropriate. By the way, there's a big debate in the Amish community about e-bikes, and we could talk about that. And I think that reveals how, anyway, I digress. But I think the challenge, though, is that there comes a time in these diseases where the devices don't work anymore. I think it gets at the fact that things are getting so complicated, decisions need to be made, not by you alone, the human with the disease, but by other humans to support you in making decisions. And there's no question that AI is beginning to make decisions. It's getting, dare I say, intelligent. I think, though, that for this complicated problem called dementia, there comes a time when carbon needs to step in and starts to have to care, meaning another human. You know, I'm kind of playing with, you know, I said silicon. Oh, you know, all these devices, ultimately, they're not alive. They're silicon-based. But there's something about us that we're alive. We have a mind. And I think at some point that another mind is needed. But I think devices are pushing that back. I think that the ability to wire up your house and your life are giving people a degree of independence, autonomy that they did not have before, which gets back to e-bikes.
You mentioned this person who put devices in place that allowed his mother to stay in her apartment for 3 years longer than she would have otherwise. What kinds of devices are these? Are these like alarms? Are they?
It was unbelievable. And so I'm working on this essay and he's going to be the treatment. Like, one of them was, and they're all like simple stuff. He's like, yeah, $15 on Amazon. He obviously was extremely technically savvy. He'd studied computer science as an undergrad. He's an entrepreneur, inventor, you know, stuff like that. But one of them was this device that allowed him to turn his mother's TV on, to turn it on, pick the station, the whole deal, remotely, completely. Because his mother no longer, she couldn't work the remote control. He got her a simple remote control, you know, like two buttons, that's it. But it just became hopeless. And he would call her up and say, Mom, the French Open's on. Because he turned the French Open on. And she's like, oh, thanks. You know, I don't know how you did it. So the other was, he set up a whole host of ways to monitor the climate in the house. So she would open a window because she wanted fresh air. And in Philadelphia, there are certain times of the year where opening a window can be pretty dangerous. Now, one day she opened up the window and it was 90 degrees out. And he walks in the apartment, it was like 95 degrees. Now, you and I both know as physicians that that's a ticket for dehydration, a disaster. And so what he set up were temperature sensors that allowed him to know, all this remotely, the ambient temperature of a room in the outdoors and whether the window was open. And if the window was open and the ambient temperature between outdoors and indoors differed by more than 5 degrees, and the ambient temperature indoors was above or below a certain threshold, he would get an alarm and could call her and or go over to her house and close her window. I mean, that's incredible. And it went on from there. Motion detectors. If she doesn't activate the motion detector to go into the bathroom by 11 a.m., alert me, because by then she should be up and there's something wrong. A medication delivery device. So meds were delivered. No need to be reminded. No need to, there they are. And he got a signal. Meds have been taken out of the cup. It is just incredible what he did. And all that he emphasized was stuff he was able to get, you know, no devices. Well, the pill thing was, you know, like a device he paid for that was made by a company, but everything else was kind of DIY kind of stuff. Yeah.
In your book, you talk about this idea of home looseness. So when home no longer feels like home, and sometimes that means modifying the home as this person that you're talking about, sometimes this means moving to a facility, skilled nursing facility or some other facility. There's some kind of wacky examples in the book of like whole towns and communities, like dementia towns with regulated temperatures and things like that. So I'm wondering, where are you right now on reimagining long-term care environments? Is it just case by case, depends what the person needs, or how are you thinking about counseling families about the environment and where their loved one is best served?
My thinking about home continues to deepen and widen. And my latest thoughts on home translate into one phrase, which I'm going to say, and I think many of your listeners might be bothered, which is the idea of, I will never leave this home, I will stay in this home forever, is wrong. It doesn't mean that you must leave your home, but I think we have to be open to the fact that it's not about the dwelling, the specific place, the address, these very rooms and the stuff in them. It's about the feeling of being at home and how can we create that. And I think all of us, if we reflect upon our lives, particularly, you know, over the course of decades, have changed the places that we were in part because of just things we had to do. We had to go to college or grad school or, you know, the army, whatever. But once you went to that place, you made it work. You made it feel like home, or you didn't and you changed it. Okay. And I think that is what we do as humans. And I think what we want to avoid, I called it home looseness because I was trying to play on homelessness, right? You're unloosened from the feeling of being at home. Another way to frame that is nostalgia, in the true meaning of the word nostalgia, which is the Greek nostos combined with algia. And it's this feeling of missing home. That is where nostalgia came from. It was coined by a Swiss physician in the 1700s who had observed all these servants and soldiers and other individuals who were far from their homes. And mind you, back then, you couldn't just hop on your cell phone or even write a letter with confidence that would get to someone. And they felt a profound sense of homesickness, nostos algis. And I think the care of persons with dementia is to address that feeling. The challenge of that is often when it occurs in the course of a disease that causes dementia, the person's not capable of saying, you know, I just don't like being here. This isn't working for me. I want to move that. And, you know, they don't redecorate. Other people have to step in and do that. That gets back to caregiving. And I do find myself sometimes telling caregivers, home is not working here. This person needs to be in a different home. The space isn't working. I know you feel bad about moving them. And this gets at issues of the lousy quality of other residential long-term care setting. But what you're describing simply isn't working anymore. They're suffering too much from nostalgia. So that's where I'm going on this concept of home. And I think it foregrounds, you know, the need to really address our fractured, lousy, messed up, and sadly, if the current budget passes, even more messed up system of long-term care services and supports for Americans.
And when you say that to families, home isn't working, how do you know and how might families know when home isn't working? Is it when the patient or the person is falling? Is it when they're wandering? Is it when it's behavioral issues?
It's when the answer to what's a typical day describes a place that is no longer fully safe and social and engaged. That you clearly hear someone who is really not living a life that achieves those three important features of what it means to live well, that I feel safe, I'm reasonably social, and I'm engaged in things. Can't do all three at once to the max, but you know, I think all of us strive to sort of live that way. So when you start hearing a story that's being told to you that, boy, this is really unsafe, or it's safe, but gosh, there's just nothing going on anymore. You know, you're hearing a story of, we need to rejigger the environment, the people, the objects, et cetera, to try and get back to some axes of those three things that allow us as humans to flourish.
You just mentioned the budget, and in your book, you talk about this idea of wealth care instead of health care, which captures the entanglement of financial planning and dementia health care. So tell us about the intersection of dementia and wealth or finances, and you know, that could be at the level of the family, or that could also be at the level of the economy. And how are you thinking about what needs to go on, you know, I guess for families, but also in a larger policy sense for how we, I guess, stop the bleeding in a way of the money that is just being poured into this problem, in some cases effectively and in some cases not so effectively.
Yeah, I mean, health and wealth are intimately connected. I mean, there's lots of data, for example, that just the more wealth you have, the healthier you are, you live longer, which is a marker of health. You also want to have not just lifespan, but health span. But, you know, in America and in many other countries, those data are very clear. With respect, though, to diseases of the brain, I think health and wealth are even more tied together. And at the individual level, I think one very plain reason is because one of the earliest troubles if you have a disease like Alzheimer's or Lewy body disease or TDP-43 disease or vascular disease or combinations of those diseases, you'll have trouble managing your finances, you know, organizing your financial affairs, using the financial services system in America. And indeed, those data are out there, you know, namely that the financial services industry, the banking industries, all will tell you that when they look at the client data from age about 70, 75 on, you know, password resets, repeated calls to the call center, suspicious or unusual charges, debts, et cetera, all start to appear in the accounts. So in some sense, you know, monitoring financial skills is a way to detect disease in the brain. And that's, the firms know this. And there's good data that, you know, markers of financial well-being start to get affected antecedent to an incident diagnosis of dementia, namely markers of debt and credit scores start to change. Not enough that they should be diagnostic, but I think they further sort of robustly support that our financial services system, whether it likes it or not, it has a role in sort of monitoring, detecting, and trying to maintain the brain health and the wealth, see, the connection of Americans. As you start to add that up, though, of course, if you're going to live for a decade or so with these diseases, about average time is about a decade, very variable, of course, you need some wealth because, you know, all the things that we've been talking about, the care that you need, the mind support requires time and places and objects, and you got to pay for that. I know this personally. I went through it with my father who died of sort of mild stage dementia. And he was paying about, out of his accounts, about $2,000 a month for people to come in and take him out for various errands and et cetera. And that came out of his accounts, you know, money he had earned. And so you need that wealth and you don't want to lose it from fraud and whatnot if you're going to be cared for with this disease. And it translates into hundreds of thousands of dollars for some families, either spent money and or lost wages because instead of working, you took time to care for your relative, which particularly affects the American family. If you add this up on a policy level, it becomes rather monstrous as a problem. And we've done a lousy job addressing it as a nation. And there was nothing in the 1980s. Medicaid, the federal program in cooperation with states, did step in and created some long-term care services and supports contingent on people meeting various poverty thresholds. And for many of the people who use Medicaid right now in America, are not the stereotype 30-year-old playing video games on their couch. I think that's the latest rhetorical punch that we're hearing, that the problem with Medicaid is 30-year-old males in their basement couch playing video games. But a vast constituent that uses Medicaid services and supports are persons with dementia, older adults. About 20% of Medicaid is their care. And I have spoken with caregivers and patients who use those services and supports. And I asked one of them, a patient, what would it be like if you lost this? And she said to me, I'm so afraid about that. I'm even more afraid of that than I am of my disease. Which kind of sums it up.
You just talked a lot about the financial dimension of this disease. Talk about some of the other complex rights that patients have to talk about with their families when their cognition is declining, for example, driving, voting, things like that. How do you talk to families about preserving independence and when it's time to take certain rights away and what that looks like? And how do you navigate that? And how do you suggest that families think about navigating that?
Yeah. So two things. One, you mentioned the car, the automobile, and that has its own sort of separate valence, namely the public health aspect of someone who's having trouble driving. And in many states, of course, there's, you know, laws and requirements that people who have diseases, diagnoses that can impair their ability to drive need to be reported because of the harms that can cause to others, you know, because of that. So recognizing that, though, I think in general, I try to push that the idea behind caregiving and living with these diseases, that dynamic, should be governed by this idea of what's called supported decision making. And it's a term that came out of the legal literature largely to address the challenges of transitioning from childhood into adulthood with a developmental disability, persons with Down syndrome, for example, where the defaults tended to be, well, just put them under a guardianship. because they've got some troubles making decisions. Up until the age of 18, the family just kind of did it because they were a child, and by law, they couldn't make decisions. But now that they're 18, 19, and, you know, they've got a job and whatnot, but, you know, they struggled making some decisions, just put them under guardianship, and then the family will just continue to take care of them like they were a child. And that kind of is the norm out there. The people with Down syndrome began to push back on that. And the result were some court cases that led to this concept of supported decision making. I don't like the framing because it's often called a less restrictive alternative to guardianship, as though guardianship's the default. But I think in the lives of persons living with diseases like Alzheimer's or Lewy body disease or TDP43 disease, that as they start to develop symptoms, it's not that they go from having the ability to exercise their daily life, their rights, if you will. It's that they go from being whatever level of function and they had to needing support still, particularly around making decisions. And the role of a caregiver is to support them in that decision-making. Many caregivers, when you describe it, it's like, well, yeah, that's what I do. But it's not formalized into thinking. It's not formalized into the way we talk to caregivers about what they're doing. And I think many struggle with it sometimes, particularly that, so, well, I just take care of everything, you know. Well, no, I mean, you know, she needs support here, not just you to sort of completely strip her rights away. So a good example, apropos, say, voting, for example, is, I'm going to draw a hard line. I can't vote for you. I can't go, well, I think Emily would vote for her, so I'm going to, can't do that. You can't delegate your citizenship. But you can get a lot of support up to that moment in the ballot box or filling out your absentee ballot where you are supported, namely filling out the forms to get the ballot, getting to the ballot if you decide to vote in person. You can even request assistance in the polling booth to help read the ballot and pick who you want. And I think that's a good example of supported decision making in action. I'm not voting for you. I'm not making the decision about who to vote for, but I'm going to do a lot of things to help you get to that decision. Now go ahead. Just who do you want to vote for? You know, A or B?
We opened up talking about new drugs coming on the market and some of the flawed ways that that process is taking place. Tell us about what's happened since that epilogue, or since that incident that you added the last chapter to your book. What is the state of pharmacology in particularly Alzheimer's, although I'll leave it open to any type of dementia? And how are you thinking about that? I mean, I know you've said in the past that we're not going to drug our way out of this disease, of course, because it is so complex and there's so many different elements. And as of yet, the drugs aren't miraculous, but what is the state of the science and how are you thinking about pharmacology?
Yeah, so since the book was written, not one but two anti-amyloid drugs in the same class as aducanumab, which is no longer on the market, two anti-amyloid drugs completed phase three clinical trials that met the standards for FDA review. And both studies showed a clear difference between people on drug versus placebo on pre-specified primary endpoints, with the secondary endpoints also lining up in the direction of favoring drug as effective over a comparative placebo. And FDA granted both drugs full approval, not accelerated conditional, but full approval for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease presenting either the mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia. And those drugs are now available. I prescribed them just today off the phone talking with a family member and patient who have decided to take one of the drugs. And the data on them show that they change the trajectory of cognitive decline, functional decline over about 18 months of delivery, meaning a progressive widening between drug and placebo over time. They don't flatten the curve of decline. They slow its slope. There's a lot of variability within individuals, which reflects the fact that there's a lot of variability of pathology within individuals. Hence, that's why I think we see some respond quite well, some don't respond much at all. So they're out there, they're available. We're prescribing them at the Penn Memory Center. I'm prescribing them. What's fascinating about the drugs is they really sort of fueled the business model that have really moved biomarker tests from kind of the penumbra of research and clinical practice into clinical practice. And I don't mean to dismiss the drugs. I prescribe them. I think that they're effective and available for patients who want them. But to be honest, I think the most exciting development in the field is the ability now to use a variety of biomarker tests to diagnose in life whether your dementia or your mild cognitive impairment are caused by a neurodegenerative disease. And we've got good tests for Alzheimer's. We have emerging tests for Lewy body disease and emerging tests for TDP-43 disease. And I think the future is only more brilliant for the kinds of tests that are going to be available. And what they're doing is they're changing what used to be kind of inherently a mystery story into a different kind of story. So inherently, dementia was always a bit of a mystery story. You told me your story, I examined you, and I said, you know, this really looks like a classic Alzheimer's disease. It really does. I said, okay, great. You know, are you certain? Well, yeah, I am. Well, you know, in truth, I was certain enough that I was able to say it, but until you died and the neuropathologist looked at your brain, we don't really know that you had Alzheimer's. And that was the truth. And I would tell people that. So it was probable Alzheimer's. And what's happened with biomarkers is in a matter of days, not years until you die, I can order biomarker tests that say, yeah, the pathology's there. And that's just breathtaking. I've done the same with Lewy body disease now. And I have several cases of patients. I have several patients who I undiagnosed of their Alzheimer's disease. It was classic Alzheimer's, classic amnestic Alzheimer's. But, you know, the story wasn't totally perfect, but, you know, whatever, a lot of variability. So I ran Alzheimer's biomarker test, stock negative, reimaged there on MRI, and it's the pattern seen in TDP-43 disease. And this completely changes the narrative of illness because you're saying this is what the problem is. It's not this, it is this. And vice versa. I've taken patients with MCI who in days of old, I would have been like, you know, there's a 10%, 20% risk per year of depression, dementia. Keep an eye on how you're doing. I'll see you back in a year. I mean, that's literally what I offered them. So basically, I told you back what you already told me. I have mild cognitive impairment. Thank you. And basically threw a risk number on it and said, see you back in a year. Keep an eye on the finances. Now I can run these biomarker tests and say, your mild cognitive impairment is the early presentation of Alzheimer's disease. And while one patient told me that, this is not good news, it was very settling news for him. Because, you know, he felt like he was going crazy. And he really wondered, like, is this just me? And no, the answer is no, you've got Alzheimer's. That's what's going on here in your brain. We can see it on these tests. And so it's completely changing, beginning to change, the illness narratives of what it's like to have these diseases. That's what's happening. I'm not trying to discount the importance of the treatments, but, you know, they're available for a narrow window of patients. But I can run these tests across the dimensions of the clinical syndromes. And that to me is what's most exciting. We're changing the way we talk about the brain medically, which is changing the illness experience in ways that I think will change what we talk about when we talk about these diseases.
I've just got two more questions for you, short ones. What are the most difficult aspects of your everyday work, and what are the most fulfilling aspects of your everyday work?
The most difficult aspects of my everyday work are the threats to the ability of academic medicine to function. In the last several months, we've lost grant funding. We've seen Medicaid support threatened. I'm at an institution which is under investigation for claims that we violated certain federal laws, which I don't think we did. And the result is a milieu which has really gone from being exciting, particularly in the Alzheimer's space, we're really making progress finally, to being one that's full of threats and fear. I had a reporter reach out to me that wanted to talk about this, and I said, I'll do it, but it has to be off the record. Okay, here I am talking on a podcast about it, but I haven't spoken about any specific grants that we lost. But yeah, it's just not an environment and a milieu that's good. We had 9 applicants for our fellowship program, and we were going to take 3. But when these events started to unfold, we're like, we're going to need our reserve funds. So we only took 1. You know, because we just couldn't do it. So that's 2 people that could become future Alzheimer's specialists that we didn't train. That causes me a lot of distress. I worry about the future of research and training and care. I just don't understand why that's happening. What's most rewarding is it's very exciting to take care of patients who have these diseases, because it gets to the heart of these diseases threaten what it means to be human. These are big problems, and I just find it very rewarding. And it's not to dismiss the gravity of other diseases, cancer, heart disease, horrible lupus. You know, we could run the list. But there's something about these diseases that I find absolutely fascinating. The more I think about these, this is diseases of the mind, the more I find it incredibly rewarding, because, you know, you're sort of probing what it means to be human. And I think the advances in AI only could have further amplify how interesting that all is.
And to end, I'm wondering if you could share with us what you envision for the future of dementia care and any exciting projects that you're working on or that others are working on to realize that vision.
I think the future of dementia care will be that dementia is going to fade. I think that we're going to stop talking about dementia. We're just going to talk about the diseases that cause it. And they'll be diagnosed along a continuum of stages of severity, including diagnosis before there's any disability. I think we should anticipate a future where at some age, certain tests are done and they determine that you're beginning to develop the pathologies. And these are the steps we need to take. I think it's an incredibly exciting future. Personally, I'd like to be the beneficiary of it because America's aging and, you know, based on just demography, given my income, age, gender, et cetera, I'm probably going to live into the 70s, if not 80s. And so odds are I'm going to have cognitive impairment. The lifetime risk is 42%. So I think that is the future. And I think it's a huge opportunity, but it's an enormous challenge because we still have a polluted language about these diseases. You know, we fear them in ways that we inflect with lurid metaphors of, you know, death and whatnot. But I hope to be part of the conversation that changes that. I think you will too, Emily.
Well, thank you. It's really wonderful to speak with you. I love the way that you talk about dementia and your work and the way that you pull in not just medical science, but history and even to an extent, philosophy, and even to an extent, maybe a little bit of poetry too. And you do seem a bit like a Renaissance man of sorts. So I'm glad that you're on the case and would love to talk again sometime. You know, there's so much in here. And
if listeners want to learn more about the work I do, they can visit my website. It's just my name, jasoncarlowish.com. And all the writings I've done and stuff are there and some video links to some other talks. So yeah, check it out.
Fabulous. Yes, I have been speaking with Dr. Jason Carlowish, physician, professor, philosopher, poet, ? wonderful to speak with you today. And thanks for coming on Remo.
Yeah, thanks, Emily. Great to be here.
Thanks for listening to Talking Dementia with Remo Health. If you're looking for more information, resources, and expert insights, visit remo.health. And subscribe so you never miss an episode. Until next time, take care.